Okay.
There's only one worse slot to teach him than 6:30 p.m. Tisha B'Av afternoon, and that is before Ne'ilah on Yom Kippur, when I feel people look at me as though like I'm their favorite snack, or you know, I'm like a burger to some people. I'm like a roast beef sandwich to other people. I'm sorry, I don't mean to put these things in your mind. A piece of pizza to others, you know. But I just really want to commend everyone. I want to commend everyone for being here, and not just for being here, but taking this day as seriously as our tradition wants us to take the day seriously. I actually asked this past Wednesday night our students. I don't know, it was probably about 15 students or so. I said, "How many of us actually grew up with Tisha B'Av?" And out of the 15, 16 students, there were maybe two or three that raised their hands. And so I think it's a real credit. Welcome. I think it's a real credit to all of you. Come to some seats over here. And I got some more handouts that you've come to join. Thank you. There's a seat over here. You can get a tan. And you'll be very embarrassed if you fall asleep. But otherwise, a really great seat. Okay. That didn't go over. All right. Usually these jokes get a laugh, but it's usually when people... What's that? Yeah, yeah. Yeah? Okay, cool. We're trying to Facebook Live this. We decided to do this last second. As you can see by our very sophisticated apparatus... I want to thank Yoel for trying to share this Torah with a lot more people that are actually in the room. So thank you, Yoel, for doing this. Everybody have a little packet, a little handout. Guys in the back. So this passage in the Talmud I've been teaching for many, many years. I'm really always open to new interpretations and understandings. And what I'd like to try to do with you... Oh, look at that. Okay, great. What I'd like to do with you... Now I really feel I have to be animated. Is try to, first of all, understand the story. To really understand what's going on in the Gemara here, this passage. It's 4 or 5 pages in the Talmud and the Tractate of Gittin. And try to understand also its modern-day implications. You guys with me? How we doing? Yeah. You all right? Woo. All right, we're here. Okay. All right, our first customer has to leave already. Okay, something I said? I got you. Okay, here we go. We're on the right-hand column. Yeah, she's so upset she can't be here. It's terrible. The right-hand column on the bottom, where it says, Akamtzu bar kamtzu chavru Yishalayim. And the Talmud just tells us very, very straightforward... in a very straightforward fashion, that because of the story that the Gemara is going to tell us, that we're going to get into in just a moment, because of this incident in the Jewish community, of this fight between these two guys, Jerusalem was destroyed. Now we're going to have to delve into that. Do we read this literally? Like literally because these two Jewish people fought all of Jerusalem and the Second Temple at the hands of the Romans fell? Really? Well... follow with me in the story. Here we go. Dahu Gavra, there was once a person, a man. Derachme Kamta, he had a friend whose name was Kamta. Ubal Dabave, and he had an enemy named Bar Kamta. What's the name of the guy who has a friend whose name is Kamta, and he has an enemy whose name is Bar? We don't know. And the Talmud never tells us. And we're going to have to come back to that to try to understand why don't we know. Anyway, Avad Seudasa. It's unclear why, but he was throwing a big party. Amar Le Lishamei. He's obviously a wealthy guy because he's got attendants. He's throwing a banquet. So he's not a nobody, or at least he has a few bucks. And he tells his attendant, Zil Aisili Kamta. Go and invite Kamta. Right? Here's the invitation list. Under B. No. I really haven't eaten. Under K. Kuf, you should find Kamsa. Invite him. Let's turn the page. Azal Aisile Bar Kamsa. Turn to page 2, please. I want to thank Rabbi Artscroll for the translation here. It's excellent. By the way, this is also a great example of, if you haven't studied, you haven't been raised to learn Talmud, I mean, you've got it right here. The Artscroll is pretty unbelievable. It gives you like word-for-word translation with some commentaries on the bottom. Anyway, the host says, I'm so sorry. You should not have turned the page yet. Go back to page 1. Just want to see if you're still conscious. Go back, go to the very bottom of page 1, where it says, Kamsa. The attendant went and mistakenly brought him Bar Kamsa. So he says, on the invitation list, I want you to invite my friend Kamsa. And instead, who does he invite? Bar Kamsa. Can't find good help these days. You got to be really specific when you're giving instructions to people. And Asa Ashkechei Dehava Yosef, the party is thrown. And guess who's sitting there at the party? At whoever, whatever the big macher's name, we don't know who he is, who's throwing the party. He comes and lo and behold, who does he see at the event? He sees Bar Kamsa sitting there. Amar Leh, he says to Bar Kamsa, Michtei Hahu Debava Dahu Gavrahu. Look, you're my enemy. What are you doing here? So what does he say to him? Ma Bayisachi, why have you come here? Now, why did Bar Kamsa come? He got an invitation. Now, if they're enemies, why is he getting an invitation to his enemy's event? So a lot of possibilities. What are you thinking about? A mistake? So if it's a mistake, like this guy's inviting me to his daughter's wedding, really? This guy's inviting me to the big party? Or, what's that? Thank you, I'm looking for an optimist. Thank you. I was looking for an optimist. Make peace! Maybe this is his way of trying to bury the hatchet. He's sitting at the party. The guy who's throwing the party sees his enemy sitting there, who he clearly did not mean to invite. This was a mistake. And he says, Mamba Yisachar, what are you doing here? Kum puk, get up and get out. Amar Leh, Bar Kamsa says to him, Hol va'asei shavkin. He realizes, if you're right, that he was trying to make an overture of peace. He realizes it's short-lived, or it was a mistake, probably. Hoel, since va'asai, I'm already here, shavkan, let me be. Okay, obviously there was a mistake. Somebody sent me the invitation. Just, you know, I'm here now. V'hivne le demei demachila v'shasina. And what does he do? He says to him, I'll pay. I'll pay for my own way. I'll pay for whatever I eat and drink. Just don't embarrass me. Which is kind of like a reasonable thing that you would say at someone else's. You just don't want to make a scene. Right? You don't want to make a scene. So you'll just say, look, I know you don't want me here. I know you're upset. We have this tiff between us. We have this terrible party. Welcome, guys. Just don't make a scene and I'll pay for my own way. So what happens? We're on the bottom. I'll turn the page now, please. Page 2. Thank you. Amar Leh, the host says, Bar Kamsa, lo, no. Whatever it is that he's upset about is angering him so much still that he's just not going, that's not good enough. He says, I'm not going to let you stay. Amar Leh, by the way, if you zoom it in, will I have to yell as much? It's a long story. I don't know, whatever, you figure that out. Amar Leh, so he says back to him, Yihivna lach, he says, no, I'm sorry, I still want you to leave. So what does Bar Kamsa say back? He ups the ante a little. Amar Leh, Yihivna lach demei palga. Palga means half. I'll give you half, de'usu desayach, half the party. It's not clear, but it looks like that could have been a lot of money. Because you'll see who's at the party soon. He's willing to pay for half the event just so that he wouldn't be embarrassed. Amar Leh, the host says back to him, Lo, no, this is not about money. Yihivna lach demei kulas udasayach. Guy comes back, I'll pay for the whole thing. Just don't throw me out. Amar Leh, Lo,
Nakte biyadei, he grabs him by the hand. The ukme, he stands him up. The afke, and he throws him out. And here's the clincher. Amar, Bar Kamsa says to himself, Hoil, vahave yasve rabbanan, since the rabbis were sitting here, they were seated at this event, velo machu bei, and they did not rebuke him, shmamina kanichi lehu, it must be that they were kanicha. Nicha means like they were okay with it. Is there a basis, is there a legitimate basis for him believing that? Is there a principle in Jewish tradition that, what's the principle? Anybody know what I'm thinking about? There is a principle in Jewish law, actually, Jewish legal practice, that if I make a deal, well, let's say I don't even shake your hand. Just felt like shaking your hand. So we make a deal and I say, hey, you know, for this prayer book, you know, $5. And you don't say anything. And you take the book, but you say nothing. Right? So that could be construed as acceptance. We have a concept that's called shtika, kehoda'a dami. Shtika means quiet, silence, kehoda'a. It's like an admission. It's like acquiescence. Like if somebody says something and you don't disagree with them, you don't oppose them, you don't protest them in any way, it can be easily construed as being, as you going along with it. That's why you have to be careful sometimes that you're not misunderstood when someone says something in your presence and you're like, well, he didn't say anything, he must be okay with it. Oh, maybe he was just being polite. I don't know. In halacha, in Jewish law, it can be construed as you're going along with it. And therefore, Bar Kamsa, the guy who was thrown out, knew that the great rabbis of the generation were seated at this event. They said nothing. They must have been okay with it. Now, is it possible that they weren't okay with it? Just we're not given all the facts here. So, what would be a possibility that the rabbis weren't okay with it, but they still kept quiet? I want to give other people a chance. Tell everyone, this is Stuart. Stuart's been coming to this class for almost the 20 years I've been teaching it. He's what you call a ringer. It's very hard for Stuart to sit at this class every year and not say anything. But I want to give people here for the first time the chance. What is a scenario, a possibility, that the rabbis were not okay about this, but they kept quiet anyway? The New York cynical side of you can come out now.
Well, I mean, I would say, Mark, that it would be overstepping their boundaries to tell the folks.
It would be overstepping their boundaries. Is it overstepping a rabbi's boundary to, like, protest something unethical or immoral that's happening in his presence? Well, it might be construed, it might be impolite, it might be construed as not being courteous, but it's probably the right thing to do if you see something wrong, especially if you're a moral figure in the community and you don't say something, you're allowing other people to think it's okay. It's a serious issue. But what's a possibility, actually? Well, we'll come back to this. I spoke with one of my mentors and teachers who suggested that it could very well be. Why were rabbis at this event? What kind of party, like, that is, it's not just for rabbis, but it somehow is attracting some of the rabbinic figures of the generation. So obviously the guy, not obviously, but it's a possibility, the guy's a big macher. The guy's like a very established, maybe helping to bankroll some of the institutions that some of these great rabbis have to raise money for. It's a possibility. And maybe they don't want to jeopardize things. It's a cynical way of looking at it. I'm going to give you a more realistic way soon. We're going to come back to this. Ezel ichol shvamina kanichele. So, Bar Kamsa is very upset. And he thinks that this is really not just his enemy embarrassing them, but that the rabbinic establishment was sort of okay with it. This is the part that is worth crying over. Ezel ichol behu kortza beimalka. So Bar Kamsa says, I'm going to effect a kortza. Kortza is is a word for Lashon Hara, for slander. Against who? Against the rabbis in the royal palace. He was upset. He wanted to get back at them. Azal Amar Leila Kesar, he goes and he tells Caesar, Mardu Bach Yehudai. The Jewish people have rebelled against you. He really wants to inform, and you know he's an important guy because it's not like everybody has the Roman ear. Now, when was this happening? It's very important to know. Take a look at the asterisk down below. At the time, the Jews had succeeded in driving Florus, the local Roman, help me, procurator, an extraordinarily cruel tyrant from Jerusalem, Agrippa II, who had allied himself with Florus, attempted to persuade Cestius Gallus, the Roman proconsul in Damascus. You getting all this? That the Jewish resistance was directed not against Florus, but against Rome. There was something going on in the Jewish community. The Jews were living basically as a vassal state under the Roman Empire. So telling the Romans that the Jews are going to rebel could be a very, very dangerous thing. It was in this context that Bar Kamtza approached the Roman authorities with his scheme to slander the Jews, and why his slander found such a receptive audience in Rome. This is not coming out of nowhere. This is not like, oh, let me see if I can get them in trouble. Something was happening already in the Jewish community. The Jews were living in Israel. Most of the Jewish people at this time, we're talking about during the Second Temple era, lived in Israel. Okay? But lived under Roman rule. And therefore, it's not like they can do anything. They didn't have full sovereignty or autonomy over their own destiny. And so going to the Romans and telling them, by the way, the Jews, they really are rebelling against you, is a very dangerous thing. Azal Amar LeKesar. Now, was this justified? You're at an event, you're publicly humiliated, the rabbinic establishment doesn't say anything, it's okay to go? I know you're all fasting. It's not justified. There's nothing justifiable. Two wrongs don't make a right. We don't believe in getting back at people. It is a biblical prohibition to seek revenge. Was it wrong what the guy who threw the party did? Of course. Was it wrong that the rabbis remained silent? Yes, and we're going to come back to that to understand that a little better. But in no way does this justify the egregious behavior of Bar Kamtza. It goes to Caesar. Mardu Bach Yedai, the Jews are rebelling. Amar Le Caesar asks Meir Mar, how do I know this? You understand the implications of a rebel group are very serious. So Caesar isn't just going to take this. Caesar needs to have evidence, has to have proof. There could be an inquiry, a Watergate of some sorts, after Caesar attacks the Jews. And what basis? Some guy, some disgruntled guy, gets embarrassed at a party and you attack the... No, I need some evidence here. Shadar le korbana. So Bar Kamtza says to Caesar, send them a sacrifice, chazis im makriven le, and see whether they offer it up on the temple. This was not an uncommon thing. The Jewish temple is primarily for Jewish sacrifices, clearly. Come. Yeah, just pull up some seats. Guys, come. The Jewish temple is obviously for Jewish sacrifices, but there were non-Jewish sacrifices brought there as well. But they have to pass muster, and they have to follow the rules and the laws of the Jewish temple. So Bar Kamtza's got this plan. He's going to convince Caesar that the Jews are really rebelling. How? Follow me. Shtar lei korbana, he says. Chazis imakriven lei. And see whether they offer it in their temple. Right? Why wouldn't a vassal state offer up an offering from the Roman Empire in their temple? Unless they were disloyal in some kind of way. Azar shadar be eglat lasa. Caesar went and sent a fine calf with Bar Kamtza. Bahade da akate, as he was going to Jerusalem. Shada be mume beniv sfatayim. Bar Kamtza caused a blemish in the calf's upper lip. The Amrle Bedukin Shiva'ayin, and some say it was in the cataract of the eye. Why does it matter where the blemish took place on the animal? Here's the most important line. Duchta a place on the animal, dilididan have a mumah, where it would be considered a blemish for us, ulididu, but for the Romans who had their own sacrificial rite, lav mumahu, it would not be considered a blemish. He creates the perfect situation to insult Caesar by causing the Jewish people, by putting them in a situation where they'd have to bring, which is a serious biblical prohibition, to bring a blemished offering on the Jewish altar in the Jewish temple. Now, before you read the next line, try to imagine yourself in that scenario. You're one of the great rabbis of the generation, and you have to figure out what to do. What are your options? Option number one, bring the blemished sacrifice and just say, you know, the peace of the Jewish people trumps, and we're just going to have to overlook a biblical prohibition. The other alternative is? What's the other alternative? Take your chances with Caesar and just tell him, I'm sorry, we can't bring your sacrifice. It's blemished. Send us something cleaner next time. What's the third option?
Kill the bull, but don't sacrifice it.
Oh.
Sacrifice.
Oh, pretend. Okay, you got to get rid of that. I thought about that one also. You just for our discussions here, none of those situations are possible. Okay, they're sending Bar Kamsa along with the animal. He's reporting on everything. There's a big video camera on everything. You can't fool the Romans. I would think that way too. It's a good suggestion. But I'm just saying, because otherwise we can't learn anything if we can just figure out another loophole around something. The Talmud is giving us a story for a reason. What's the other alternative, guys? Bring the sacrifice, dis Caesar, or no one's thinking about this. Yes?
Well, we'll talk.
Well,
I know that it's like not allowed to give this blemished animal, but if the consequences.
We don't know. Maybe they weren't so bad. Maybe the consequences weren't so bad. Maybe they're thinking, I don't know. We don't really know. Maybe they won't find out. Maybe they will find out. Maybe they won't. That maybe they'll be amenable to a different animal. They don't know. That's the scenario. That's a very good question. They don't know. It's not like you either bring the sacrifice or we attack Jerusalem. No, that wasn't the situation. Rabbis don't get clear-cut questions like that. What's the third alternative, guys? No, that's not an alternative. Because they'll figure it out. I'm just saying, the way the Gemara is going is that they're going to figure out, you can't trick them. You either have to bring the sacrifice or not, or... Yeah?
Reading ahead.
You read ahead?
Yeah.
Okay, tell everyone. Kill Bar Kamsa. You guys are Westerners. You don't think like... Okay, follow me. Sava Rabbanan Likruve. We're going to go through this now. The rabbis thought maybe they should offer it. What would be the legal basis? And Liron was alluding to this. What would be the legal basis to offer it even though it's blemished?
Law of the land.
Not law of the land. Law of the land. I mean, law of the land, when it goes up against the law of the Torah, we put the law of the land aside.
Right?
Shalom, peace. There is a category, halachic category, called Shlom Malchut, which means the peace of the kingdom. If it's going to put the Jewish people in danger, in mortal danger, then you're going to have to just suck it up, you know, and we're going to have to unfortunately have a blemished offering. However, Amar Lei, Rav Zachariah ben Avkilos said to them, Yomru Bali Mumin Kriven Lagabi Mizbech. This rabbi, who was a very, very important rabbinic figure at the time, said that people are going to then say that blemished animals, they won't know that we did this because of Shlom Malchus. They won't know we did this to save face with the Romans. And they're going to think it's okay to bring blemished offerings. So they rejected that as a possibility. I know what you're all thinking. Like, really? Why would they reject that? We're going to come back to it. Savor Lemikdalei, there's one other possibility. And that is to kill the messenger, kill Bar Kamsa. And they consider this. And now, by the way, what would the halachic basis be to kill him?
Save
to save them? What do we call that? Everything has to be framed in a halachic legal term in order for it to be permissible legally. Okay, Shlom Malchus is one legal thing, the peace of the kingdom. The other thing someone yelled it out, it's called rodef. Has anyone ever heard of that idea? Rodef is called a pursuer. So this is the halacha. If you're on the street and you see someone pursuing someone else with the intent, you somehow have the intelligence on this. You somehow have all of the information. You know that this person is trying to kill this other person. And if you don't intervene, the pursued will be killed by the pursuer. What is your responsibility according to Jewish law? One is innocent and one is not. You know this. You know all this. That's why it's not always so clear. But in a clear scenario, what's your requirement? You have to stop the pursuit to save the pursuer. Even if it requires lethal force, you're not permitted to use lethal force unless it's necessary. But you can't just stand by idly over the blood of your brother. That's a Torah prohibition. That's where Judaism is a little different. By the way, in secular law, we have such a concept. It's called third-party self-defense. Right? You're allowed to defend yourself if someone's coming after you, God forbid. Right? And someone's trying to kill you, and the only way you can defend yourself is by killing the other person. You can't be brought up on murder charges. What do you claim? Self-defense. It's the same thing for a third party. It's called third-party self-defense. If I didn't step in, judge, jury, whatever it is, then this guy would have been killed, and you get off. It's based on a Judeo-Christian ethic found in the halacha, and it's called rodef. Bar Kamsa could very easily be categorized as a rodef. What was he doing? What was Bar Kamsa doing? He was creating a scenario whereby the Jewish people would be attacked and killed by the Romans. And therefore he could be deemed a rodef, and therefore his death might be justifiable. And that's something that the rabbis considered. So they considered bringing the blemished offering, but they rejected it because people will say that blemished animals can be offered. So then they considered killing him, delolazel velema, so he wouldn't be able to go back and tell Caesar what happened. See, they couldn't switch the animals like you suggested, but they could somehow, you know, an accident can happen to Bar Kamsa, you know? Amar Lu, but they rejected that too. They said we can't kill Bar Kamsa. Why not? Rav Zechariah said, the same rabbi, Yomru Matil Mum Bekodshim Yaharig. People will then say that anyone who blemishes an animal, what's the penalty? Death. People will then think that if you blemish an animal, the penalty for that is death. Take a look at the next line. The Gemara, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Avinav Nuso, Shel Rabbi Zachar ben Avkilus, says the tolerance. It's not a great translation, actually. What does the word anivus mean? It means humility. The anivus of Rav Zachariah ben Avkilus, in refusing to have Bar Kamsa put to death, or maybe the other possibilities. Maybe just bringing a blemished offering. Not just, but bringing a blemished offering. Because of his anivus, echrivas beisenu, our temple was destroyed, v'safar tachalenu, and our sanctuary was burnt, v'higlesenu me'artzenu, and we were exiled from our land. Now what does it mean, because of his humility? So Rashi tells us, if you look at note 11 on the bottom, I circled it. Rashi tells us that Rav Zechariah, because of humility, did not feel himself qualified to make a determination that Bar Kochva posed a mortal danger to the Jewish nation. And that uses the Bar Kamsa. That explains humility. I've asked a lot of different rabbis and mentors of mine what that means. And you're going to see this continuing through the story. Yeah.
So, wasn't there, this was a...
Just speak loudly so everyone can hear.
Sure. So, weren't these Rabbanim part of the Sanhedrin? And didn't they have, like, a voting thing on things like this? Where there's, like, you know, the jar... Like, to me, like, it sounds like you're putting the onus on one person.
On one person. Oh, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I'm not a historian. I can't tell you exactly what was the state of the Jewish High Court at that moment, at that time. Were they meeting regularly? Was it a body? Or maybe they were, but rabbis still got individual questions. Not every question came before the High Court. This is obviously a very important one, but there were only certain issues, just like the Supreme Court doesn't
just doesn't have jurisdiction over every issue, every matter. There were only certain questions that came to the Jewish high court. Individual rabbis still got questions. Correct. It's a good question. Why only one rabbi? He was a... Okay, it's a good question. Although he was a very big rabbi, just want to say. Although that's not a satisfactory answer. Yeah, you want to touch him?
I would just say that, like, the story itself, I don't know how useful it is to, like, try to posit. It is very useful to posit it in history, but there's also, like, little points of, like, during the temple at that time, it was the Prushim versus the Sadukim, and not necessarily, like, rabbis necessarily making all the decisions about what's going on in the temple. If we were looking at, like, a historical kind of story about it, you could see a lot of Sadducees come in and say, this is what the Sadducees said, this is what the Pharisees said, right?
So you're suggesting that if it did go to a bigger body, it would become a bigger controversial issue. I don't know. I don't have all the facts. I don't know if all of us have all the facts.
I don't think they entered.
No, but the even if that's not exactly true, if you start posing a question to a larger forum, it's going to turn into something else. Now, I don't know. I think it's a very legit question. I think it's a very solid question. Why was only one rabbi consulted and not a group of rabbis? I hear you. One thing that I do want to share, though, that's clearly starting to unfold here, and I heard this from my teacher and rabbi of blessed memory, Rabbi Grimblatt, who I studied this with many, many years ago, and he suggested that what you're going to see in this Gemara in the next couple of pages, and what you see already, is the beginning of the great rabbinic authority and enlightenment starting to wane. You see, what this whole story is about is not simply the Roman destruction of the temple. It's about the beginning of what we call in Hebrew the Siluk HaShechina, the beginning of the departure of God's presence from the Jewish people. Who are the first people to feel the lack of closeness between God and Israel? It's the great rabbis. They're the ones who are the most connected spiritually. And the people, Rabbi Grimblatt suggested, who start feeling the lacking the most, and so much so that it actually creates a problem in their judgment and in their leadership. And you see that the rabbis were not doing a great job here. In fact, you'll see a few dialogues between the rabbis and some of the Roman officials. And I've studied a lot of Talmud in my life. I've never seen another instance where a great rabbinic figure is having a philosophical dialogue with someone else and they don't win the debate. They're always winning the debate, or if they don't win the debate, they always got they get the last word in, they got some other great insight. The word ishtik is used again and again here. They're silent. Vespasian, you'll see a few of the Roman leaders start having back and forth with the rabbis, and like, it's very uncommon in the Talmud to see the rabbis just like stopping. And this, Rabbi Grimblatt suggested, is the beginning of the Siluk HaShechina, the beginning of God. You see, the temple wasn't destroyed, and this is really the point of the story we're going to get to soon, because the Romans got the upper hand. The temple was destroyed. What was the reason? The second temple we're discussing now? Because it was a breakdown within the Jewish community. And this story of a Jew throwing out another Jew at a party and nobody saying anything about it and letting someone being humiliated, and then that Jew trying to get back at them and seeking revenge. You know, we were talking about this a little before. No one is innocent in this story. Like, who's the bad guy? Who's the good guy? There's nobody doing the right thing here. People got embarrassed. That shouldn't have happened. People kept quiet. That shouldn't have happened. And then the person who was offended and insulted goes and tells on them and creates this terrible situation with the Romans. That certainly shouldn't have happened. That's really the point of this whole story. And the rabbi's inability to maybe answer the questions and give the right psak, I think is telling. But it's part of what was happening. And the Gemara says it explicitly. Because of the tolerance, it says anivus, which technically means humility, displayed by this great rabbi, Zachariah ben Avkilus, the temple was destroyed, and our sanctuary was burned, and we were exiled from our land. Now, I want to give you another interpretation that's brought down by some of the Mefarshim and some of the commentaries. What does it mean because of his tolerance or his humility? Because he didn't give like a clear-cut, solid answer. You go to a rabbi and you want direction. Rabbi, what do I do? Can I this or that? You should do this. Okay, bring the offering. I know it's blemished. People will think what they think, but Shlom Malchus, the king, the peace of the kingdom is at stake. Or kill Bar Kamtza. Didn't do any of that. But some say that's not the humility. It's not that Rav Zachariah ben Avkilus refrained from making those decisive decisions. It's because he was one of the rabbis at the party who was quiet. That's what it means because of a nivus, because of his humility, because of his tolerance. Too much tolerance of something going wrong can be construed and was construed by Bar Kamtza as some form of acceptance of this behavior. And the rabbis are giving us a little window into what was happening in the Jewish community at the time of the Second Temple, where Jews were humiliating others. This is not some random story. Okay, this was a big party, this was a big event. If it was some sort of isolated incident, I don't think the rabbis would have wasted so much ink in the Talmud over this and encourage us to study this every Tisha B'Av. This is trying to explain to us the state of Second Temple Jewry. Now, follow with me. We're going to continue the narrative because it goes from bad to worse. You got a question? No, they didn't have an opinion. They just didn't do anything. We don't know what their opinion was. The rabbis never said... You mean opinion about what? About saying something? None of the rabbis said anything. That's all we know. That's all the Gemara tells us. Talmud tells us that they were quiet at the party. We don't really... It doesn't give us commentary like, yeah, this one was thinking this, but he didn't do bad. We don't know. We're left to really understand it to the best of our abilities today. But it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, it left the impression with the aggrieved party, Bar Kamtza, that what his enemy was doing was okay. At least in the eyes of the rabbis, and therefore in the Jewish people, that doesn't justify what he does in the Roman court, but it explains it. Page 3, let's continue. Shadar Elihu Leniron Kesar. He sends against them Nero Caesar, which is another way of saying that the Romans were convinced that the Jews were rebelling, and they send Nero. Nero is a real figure from Roman history. And they send Nero out to attack Jerusalem, Kika'ase, and as he approaches Yerushalayim, Shada Gira LeMizrach, he shoots an arrow, and Asa Nafal B'Yerushalayim, and the arrow falls in Jerusalem. Lemarav, he shoots an arrow towards the rest. Nafal b'Yerushalayim, again it falls in Yerushalayim. La'arba ruchos ha'shamayim, he shoots arrows to the four directions of the world. Asa nafal b'Yerushalayim, every single one of them falls in Jerusalem. Amar leili nuke, he then stops a little boy on the street, a Jewish kid, and he says to him, Psok li psukayich, tell me the last verse, the verse of Torah that you're now studying. Amar Lei, the boy says back, V'natati nikmati be'adam b'yadam Yisrael. The last pasuk I just learned in Cheder, I will take my revenge against Edom through the agency of my people Israel. Which is teaching basically that God is going to punish Edom. Edom is the rabbinic way of referring to Rome. Through the agency of who? Of his own people. God is going to punish them. Amar, Kutcha Brichu. So Nero has got these two things going on. On one hand, he shoots the arrows. Every direction he shoots the arrow, it falls towards Jerusalem. Then he stops a little Jewish kid on the street. Give me a pasuk. Give me the last verse he studied in Jewish school. And the kid gives him a verse. What's the verse? That God is ultimately going to punish Rome for whatever they do. Amar, Nero says to himself, Kutcha Brichu Bar Lechruve Beise. All of these omens and signs making it clear to me that what? God wants to destroy his temple.
Ubay lachpur yade bahu gavra, and he wants to wipe his hands clean through me. Arek v'azel v'igayer. He runs away and he converts to Judaism. V'nafak minei Rabbi Meir, and the great Rabbi Meir is descendant of him. It's a bizarre story. First of all, why does he run away and convert if all the arrows point towards Yerushalayim and he becomes convinced he's going to be successful? But then he realizes what? Just because you're successful at something doesn't necessarily mean there are not going to be any moral implications. He believes in God. He believes that there could be some kind of punishment for what he does. And he's convinced through this little boy's verse, thank you, through this little boy's verse, that they'll be successful, but there will be ramifications, there will be consequences. So he's like, I'm done with this. And he joins the Jewish people. And he ends up having a descendant who becomes a great Talmudic sage, Rabbi Meir. Bizarre story. By the way, there was a Kina that we read today just like that, which was worse. Nebuzaradan, the chief executioner for Nebuchadnezzar from Temple 1, the first temple, the Babylonians. He walks into the Jewish temple. The blood of Zechariah, the Jewish prophet who was killed by his fellow Jews, is bubbling in the temple. And he starts killing, goes on this murderous rampage and starts indiscriminately killing men, women, and children, Jews. And then realizes what he's doing and ends up converting to Judaism and also has a descendant who's a member of the Mishnah and one of the authors of the Mishnah that we have to this day. You have these crazy stories because, first of all, we very much believe it doesn't matter who you come from or where you come from, it's the decisions you make in your life. You say, well, you know, it's going to be successful. Is this part of Jewish history? Just because it's part of Jewish history that the temple had to be destroyed, the baseless hatred that was running rampant within the Jewish community was bringing down the second temple. The Romans were going to be the agents of God's destruction. That doesn't mean that they have to go along with it. There's a great Ramban, very important interpretation by Nachmanides, who speaks about the same thing. You remember Abraham was told, even before the Jewish people, centuries before the Jewish people would even be sent down into Egypt as slaves, what was Abraham told? Your descendants will be slaves in the land of Egypt. So what did the Egyptians do that was wrong? All the Egyptians were doing was carrying out God's will. It's part of the prophecy to Abraham. But the Egyptians did not have to go along with it. Just because something is going to happen doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be the one. That's what the Ramban writes. And it's the same idea here. That just because this was going to happen, not because of the Romans, and the Romans were going to be the ones, doesn't mean that Nero, it's a very, very powerful lesson, Nero said, I don't have to continue to do this. And he pulled out. Nero pulls out. So they got to send somebody else. Shadere Elihu Laspanios Caesar. Look at on the right-hand column on top. Caesar sends Vespasian against the Jews. Asa Tsar ala Tlat Shani. Vespasian besieges Jerusalem for Tlat Shani, for 3 years. Havu Hane Hanu Tlasa Atire. And then the Gemara, I'm going to skip over this next part, I'm just going to summarize it for you. It was a terrible siege, and this is all written about by the historians. It was a 3-year siege on Jerusalem. Now the Jews in Jerusalem had some very wealthy people that could have kept them going during the siege. I have some more handouts if anybody needs. And I'm going to skip because the Gemara then tells all these very interesting and weird stories about these three individuals, Nakdomion ben Gurion, ben Kalba Sabua, and ben Tzitzis Hakeses. There were some nicknames thrown in there, clearly. These three individuals had so much money and resources that they could have kept the Jewish community in Jerusalem alive and well during many years. For 21 years of the siege.
They could have kept us. They had enough wood. They had enough this. If you look at the resources that these guys had. But what happened? Take a look. Turn the page, please. Page 4. We're moving on. Page 4. See where I wrote continue? I'm sorry, it's a lot of scratch on this page. Page 4. Where it says continue. These three men had enough supplies to sustain the residents of Jerusalem for 21 years. Havu, Behu, Hanhu, Baryone. However, there were these Baryonim. The Baryonim were a group of zealots who wanted to fight the Romans. There was a big debate within the Jewish community as to how to deal with the Romans. And this didn't just start with Bar Kamsa. This was going on already. And if you think in 2019 we just started arguing with each other about how to deal with our enemies. Okay, if you study enough history, you'll realize it hasn't always been easy. And I'm not just talking about dealing with the external threats, but getting the people together. One of my greatest heroes of the founding of the State of Israel is Menachem Begin, for many reasons. Chief among them is he averted a civil war. Because there was a similar debate within the Jewish community between the Irgun, the Palmach, the Lechi. The Palmach was the more Haganah, mainstream, that wanted to work with the British, fight the Arabs, but work with the British. And the Jewish underground was convinced, really, that the British could not be worked with. And you have to fight with the British. You have to fight against the British too. And there were moments where it was really tense in the Jewish community. If you study some of the what happened in the mid 1940s, in a very, very difficult time, literally in the immediate aftermath of the Shoah, what was happening in Israel, the different Jewish groups, and Menachem Begin was the one when the Altalina, which was the ship that was carrying arms. And Ben-Gurion, the head of at the time of the Haganah, ordered to fire on the ship because they were convinced that it would be used by the underground. And he felt very strongly that we're going to become a state, and a state needs to have one army, not multiple armies. And therefore they fired, and Menachem Begin gave the order not to shoot back. There were Jews that were killed. But he said that the last time, and he gave this in a speech at the Knesset years later, the last time that a Jew would fight against another Jew was here. And he says, we're not going to have it again. We're going to figure out a way of remaining united against our enemies, which is not a simple thing. Take a look on page 4 in the middle. These three men had enough supplies to sustain the residents of Jerusalem for 21 years. But they were their Baryonim, Amrahula Rabbanan. The rabbi said to the Baryonim, Nepuk Venavid Shlomo Badayu. The rabbis were in favor of trying to broker a peace agreement with the Romans. And by the way, they were realists. If you study the history a little, it wouldn't be much of a fight. But the Baryonim thought they could do it. So they said, let's make peace. Lo Shavkinu, but the Baryonim who had control. The Baryonim who had control of the city gates would not let the rabbis out to try to make peace. And you'll see how tragic this was. Amru Lahu, they said to the rabbis, Nepuk Venavid Krava Badayu, we want to go fight against the Romans. Amru Lerabbanan, the rabbi said, Lo Mistaya Milsa, it's not going to be successful. You know, your idealism is praiseworthy, but it's not going to matter. Kamu klanu le'anhu amibari dechiti v'sa'ari. Chitim is wheat, barley, and wood. What they did was they got up the Baryonim and they burnt down all of those storehouses that could have kept the Jewish community alive for years, 21 years, which would have bought them a lot of time to make some kind of peace arrangement with the Romans. V'havei kafna, and they basically effected a terrible famine in Jerusalem. Let's go back. Let's continue on, because it's getting late. Take a look at the right-hand column, page 4 on the bottom. Abba Sikra Reish Bar Yonad Yushalayim Bar Achted Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai. We're going to learn a little about a great rabbinic figure, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai is probably the most important rabbinic figure at this time. And guess who Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai's nephew was? Jewish community is a very small place. He was the head of the Bar Yonim. So you have, like, literally in the same mishpacha, in the same family, you have the heads of the two different groups. The rabbi is Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, who want to make peace, and then Abba Sikra, who's his nephew, who is the head of the Bar Yonim. Shalach Lei, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai sends a message to his nephew. He says, Ta Bitzina Legabe, come to me in secret. Right? Nobody can know that this meeting is going to happen. I mean, it's ridiculous. There were times when Jewish leaders went to meet in secret with Arab leaders. Here you're talking about within the Jewish community. They had to do it secretly. Amar Lei, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai said, Ad emas abdisu hachi. How long are you going to act like this? V'katlinu la'alma b'kafna. You're going to kill us all in this terrible famine. You got to call your people off. Amar Lei, Abba Sikra said to him, My Avid, what can I do? D'iyamana lahu mide katluli, they'll kill me. The Bayonim turned out to be a crazy bunch. And if I say anything to them, you know, that's going to make it look as though I'm not with them, they're going to kill me. Amar Lei, so Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai devised the following plan. Chazili takanta lididi di'ipuk, find a way to get me out of the city. Efshar dehave itzala porta, maybe there'll be a small measure of salvation. Just get me out of the city, I want to talk to the Romans. Amar Lei, Abba Sikra said back, Nekot nafshach biktzire. Fine. Here's the plan. I need you to make believe that you are not well. Feign illness. V'lei sekulei alma v'shloi bach. And what? And let everyone come and ask about you. Michael, welcome. Thanks. So let him come and ask about you. We're on page 5 now, guys. We just moved to page 5. Take something that really smells foul, like the carcass of an animal, and lay it down next to you. So people will say that you've died. Basically, he's telling his uncle, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, we need to trick the Baryonim, and here's the way to do it. Make believe you're not feeling well, and then we're going to feign your death. So that people will then say you've died, v'la'ul bach tamidach, and that your students take hold of you and carry you out, v'lo le'ol bach inish achrina, and don't let anyone else carry your bed, d'lo l'irgashan bat kalil at, so they won't detect that you're a lighter, d'inhu yadeh, because everybody knows, d'chayi kalil mimesa, that a living person feels lighter than a corpse. Avid Hachi, Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai did exactly as his nephew suggested. Nichnas bo Rabbi Elezer mitzad echad. His student, Rabbi Elezer, the great Talmudic sage Rabbi Elezer, stood on one side, Rabbi Yeshua mitzad echar, and Rabbi Yeshua on the other side to carry the bed to the gate of the city. Kimatu lepitcha, when they got to the entrance, bo lemitzkere. The Baryonim are guarding the entrance. They know what's going on. They're not fools. They want to make sure no one's getting out and trying to make any peace with the Romans because they want to fight the Romans. So they want to make sure. So what do? Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai, you know, they want to take their spears and stick it into the coffin to make sure he was really dead. Amar Lei, so Abba Sikra said to them, Yomru Rabbanan Dakru. This is terrible. The Romans are right here. Are you going to let the Romans say that the Jewish people stab their own rabbis? Boi Lemitche. The Baryonim wanted to push him at least. They wanted to shove the coffin around to see if any sounds would come from there. So Amar Lehu, Yamru Rabban Zachafu. I love this line. Then they're going to say that Jews push around their rabbis. Which of course never happens. The Jews don't push around their rabbis. Jews treat their rabbis nicely. So we don't want them to think that their rabbis get pushed around. Finally, it works. Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai gets himself out, this little kind of Trojan horse situation. When Rabbi Yochanan Ben Zakkai reaches the Roman camp, Amar, Shlomo Alach Malka, Shlomo Alach Malka, it's a very famous Gemara.
He says to Vespasian, why is it Vespasian? Because remember what happened to Nero? Right? He's learning in some yeshiva now. Right? Ama Shlomo Alach Malka, Shlomo Alach Malka. Peace be unto you, O King. Peace be unto you, O King. Vespasian gets upset. Vespasian says, Mechai v'tshrei katle. You should be killed for two reasons. You're deserving the death penalty for two reasons. Why? Chada, first, Delav Malka anav ka karisli Malka. First of all, I'm not a king. I'm not Caesar. And you're mocking me by calling me a king. That's like telling someone, you know, like, you're a nobody because you're not the next, you know, rung up on the ladder. Vesu, and furthermore, I Malka anav, if I am a king, then ad ha'ina amai lo asis lagabe, then what took you so long? Why haven't you come and try? You're the head of the... You're like the leader in the Jewish community. Where have you been? How come you haven't been able to come and talk to me if I'm such an especially important person? So Amalei, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said back to him, to Kamart, Lav Malka, to that which you say, I'm not a king. Turn the page to 6. We're getting near the end. Ibra Malka At. The truth is, you're not a king now, but you're destined to become the king. How do I know? De'i lav malka'at, because if you are not destined to be a king, lo meimra Yerushalayim bi'adach, lo mimasra, sorry, Jerusalem would never fall into your hand. He had a sense of what was happening already, that Jerusalem was about to fall to the Roman hands and Vespasian was the man. And the Pasuk says in the Torah, v'halevanon ba'adir yipol, the Lebanon, which is another way of referring to Jerusalem, shall fall to a mighty one. The Ein Adir El Melech, and a mighty one is only a king. Tichsev Aya Adirim Imenu. The Ein Levanon El Beit Migdash Hahara Tov Al Zeh. He starts giving all the verses. You may not be a king now, but you will be. Utaka Amart. And the second thing, you said that I'm worthy of the death penalty for two reasons. The second thing, which you asked me, I Malka Ana. Amai lo ka'asis legabe ad ha'ina. If I am a king, why have you not come to see me until today? Baryana de'isle ben shafkinan. I have a very simple answer for you. The baryanim amongst us would not let us leave the city. Amrulei, Vespasian says back to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, ilu chavis shel dvash v'darkon karuch aleha. If there was a keg of honey and a dangerous snake was wrapped around the keg of honey, and you wanted the honey, lo ayu shovrin es achavis b'shvil darkon, would you not break the keg because of the snake, so the snake will go away? You should have destroyed the walls of the city so the baryonim could be driven out. You should have fought against them. Look at note number 8. Roman forces should be able to enter the city and expel the baryonim. All you had to do was pierce the walls, and we would have taken care of those baryonim. Now this is interesting. Whether you like Vespasian's answer or not, what's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's response? Ishtik. Remember I talked to you before about ishtik? Ishtik means silence. There's no other place, at least I'm aware of in Shas, in the Talmud, where the rabbis are quiet. Especially after debating someone in philosophy or in something of this matter. This is the beginning of the Siluk HaShchina, the removal of God's presence. The great Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is stunted. And Vespasian has the last word. However, Kari Ale Yosef Yitema Rabbi Akiva, the Talmud then tells us what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should have said. Had he had God with him a little closer, had the Chorba not started already, he should have answered what? Meshiv Chachamim Achorba Datam Yisakel. God turns wise men backwards, makes their thinking foolish. Ibai Le Lameimar. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should have said, if a dangerous snake were in pursuit of a keg of honey, we would take tongs, grab hold of the snake, and kill it. And we would leave the keg intact. So basically, Vespasian was saying they should have destroyed the city walls so that Baryonim could be expelled. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai should have responded that they were waiting for an opportunity to drive out the Baryonim without having to destroy the city walls. He didn't have that insight. Again, it's another expression of the presence of Hashem, of the Almighty, beginning to depart from the Jewish people. And who feels it the first? The great rabbis. Now this is a part that's really just so painful, because look at the narrative is resumed here. Just follow with me a little. In the meantime,
a messenger, stand page 6 with me, arrives from Rome, tells Vespasian, arise, for Caesar has died, and they've decided to appoint you as leader. Exactly what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had told him. You may not be a king now, you will be a king, takes place right in front of Vespasian's eyes. And then it says that Vespasian was wearing only one of his shoes at the time. He tried to put on the other shoe, it wouldn't go on. And then he attempted to take the other shoe off, but it wouldn't come off. And he realized that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is a very wise man. So he says, what's going on with my feet, with my shoes? I mean, it sounds comical, but my high, what's this? Amalei Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, don't be upset. Lo titzta'er, shmua tovet asyalach. It's because you just received good news. The joy of hearing good news makes a person's body swell. There's such a verse for this. I have no time to talk about it. Just take his word for it for the time being. Elamaita kanta. Okay, great. You have a very nice verse for this, but what do I do about my feet? I can't get them into my shoes. Lese inish delo mechayv de'adate minach v'lechamei kamach. Let a man who you dislike come and pass in front of you. And he brings verses for this. Vespasian follows his advice, and boom, the shoe goes right on. Now, why is this important? It's important because Vespasian starts becoming impressed pretty quickly with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And he says to him, Ad ha'ina, he asks him the same question again. Ad ha'ina amai lo asisu legabe. You know, it's like he's taking a liking to him. He's like, why didn't you come and talk to me earlier? Now, he already gave him the answer for that. But it's like, you know, when you get it, you don't know somebody, and all of a sudden you develop a rapport really quickly. You start liking the other person. You start like, hey, you know, we should hang out more often. Like, what happened here? Why haven't you come? And he said back, V'lo amri lach, did I not tell you this before? Right? Vespasian then said, you know, I told you the Bar Yonin. So what does Vespasian say? Ana nami amri lach. I also answered you before. So he says, Mezel azine v'inish achrina. Listen, I'm going back to Rome. I just got a big promotion. They're going to send someone else to take my place. Now, he may not be as impressed with you as I am. So what does he say? Ella bai, by the way, I just said that. That wasn't the Gemara. I just want to be clear. Ella bai midei de'etan lach. Ask me something I can give you. And this is a very famous thing. He asked Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, tell me something I can do for you. And famously, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai answers, Tein liyavne v'chachameha, give me the town of Yavne and its sages. V'shulashtad Rabbi Gamliel, the family of Rabbi Gamliel, v'avasnad nesayim lebei Reb Tzadok, and the doctor to cure Reb Tzadok. Of course, everybody's asking, what do you mean? He's asking something. This guy's going to become Caesar. What should he have asked for? Right? Call off the dogs. Tell the Romans to turn around and go back to home. Call off the... Now, obviously, that was the next couple of lines. You can see explain why he didn't ask. Who savar dimla kulai hai lo avid? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was convinced at this time that if he didn't ask for something that Vespasian was capable of providing, he'd get nothing. Famous line elsewhere in the Talmud: Tafasta maruba, lo tafasta. Try to grab onto everything, you get nothing. He realized it was too late. But at least let me preserve the Jewish community. And actually, in a brilliant request, he preserves the Jewish community by getting three things. And these are obviously very spiritual things, because that's what we believe preserves and sustains the Jewish people. It's not our armaments, it's not F-16s, and we need F-16s, and we're appreciative of those F-16s. But at the end of the day, it's all a question of whether or not why we are here as God's special people is preserved. So he says, Tein li Yavne. What was Yavne? Yavne was the greatest academy and all of its sages. Make sure that the great rabbinic sages and their scholarship isn't wiped out. I spoke about this morning. Of Salvechik says that during the First Crusade, we read keynote this morning about the Crusades, wiped out in the year 1096, wiped out a lot of the Bali HaTosfos. The Bali HaTosfos were If you open up a Talmud to this day, on the right-hand side is Rashi, on the left-hand side, 60 great scholars. A lot of the Baalei Tosfos were destroyed along with their scholarship. Had it not been for Rashi, who lived in France, and because the great Torah scholars at that time in our history were centered more in Germany, Rashi was sent as a small boy to Germany to learn from the greats. And thank God he came back to France to try to build up France as a new Torah center, because the Crusaders came in and wiped out the communities of Mainz, Spire. What were the others?
Worms.
Talked about these great communities. And Rav Soloveitchik said that as great as the Rambam was, as great as Maimonides, if anyone's interested, the Jewish Center is having a mincha. If you haven't prayed the mincha service, anybody's interested, there's mincha going on the first floor downstairs, if anybody needs. That as great as Maimonides, as the Rambam was, the oral tradition could have been preserved without the Rambam, but not without Rashi. Without Rashi, we would have simply lost too much of an understanding of the oral tradition. We wouldn't be able to practice our Judaism to this day. And that's what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was trying to do. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was trying to preserve the great scholarship, the Torah. And why the family of Rabbi Gamliel? Rabbi Gamliel was the one rabbi who could trace his lineage to the Davidic dynasty. Today's Tisha B'Av, we believe, still got a little time for the Mashiach to still come. Mashiach is supposed to establish himself as a direct descendant of King David. And Rabbi Gamliel was able to do that. So he wanted to preserve the Messianic lineage. And finally, a cure for Reb Tzedek. Reb Tzedek was considered the most pious of the generation. And we have a belief, we have a tradition, that the world only continues, and the Jewish world only continues, through the zechut, the great merit of the, some say, the Lamed Tet Tzaddikim, the 36 special righteous individuals of every generation. I have to check it out. Oh, the 36, I don't know. The 36, I don't know. But it's all over rabbinic Talmudic tradition that in order for the Jewish people to continue, there is a need for certain very pious individuals. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Tzedek was convinced that Rabbi Tzedek was such a person. We're going to finish up the Gemara now. And Vespasian's stepson is basically called to replace him. Remember, we go from Nero to Vespasian. And what was Vespasian's stepson's name? Titus. Or Titus. Azel Shdari Letitus Va'amar. Titus is the one who said, "I Elemo Tsur Chasav. Where is their God, the rock in whom they seek refuge?" Zet Titus Arasha. This is a reference to the evil Titus. Shechera V'gidev Klape Mala, who profaned and blasphemed God above. Ma'asa, what did he do? Tafas Zona Biyado, when he came to Jerusalem, he took a harlot, a prostitute, in his hand. The Nichnas Lebeit Kodshei Kardashim, and he goes into the Holy of Holies. Vitziyu Sefer Torah, and he spreads out the Torah scroll. The Avar Aleha Avera, and he commits a terrible sin upon it. The Natal Sayef Vigider et Parochet, he takes out a sword. He slashes the parochas. The parochas is the hanging that separates the different parts of the sanctuary. Vinasa Nes, and a miracle took place. Vahe Adam Mevad Sveitz Viyotze, blood started bubbling out of the parochas. Ukesavor, and he, in some ridiculous way, thought to himself, Harag Es Atzmo, that he had killed God himself. Shneamar, and he brings the pasuk that explains all of this. Now, the next two or three pages I'm going to leave for you. You can take this home and read the next two pages on your own. It talks about Titus and some other crazy things about Titus. And by the way, Titus became very famous because if you go to Rome to this day, you'll see the Arch of Titus. What's on the Arch of Titus, by the way? You see the Roman legionnaires carrying off vessels from the temple. The most inspiring thing about it is to see if you turn to the right. I don't know if it's still there. I haven't been to Rome in a long time, but when I was there, somebody had graffitied "Am Yisrael Chai." The Jewish people are alive.
Crazy.
It was some Israeli tourist.
The heck with you, and pulled out a spray pad.
I'm not advocating, taking historical sites and. But you should just know that's why when people always talked about for centuries, where are the vessels of the temple? And everybody always pointed to the Vatican. They used Titus as some sort of evidence that if the Romans who vanquished our second temple, they were the ones who took away, they were the ones. I mean, there are families. I was just in Italy. I had the honor of performing a wedding in Florence this summer, a couple of weeks ago. And I met a family, actually. We went to Venice for Shabbos, which was just absolutely beautiful. And my wife and I were sitting there, and there's another couple, just wanted to make conversation. So they live in Milan, and I said, just how long has your family been living in Italy? And they looked at each other, and they smiled. And so she turns back to me, she says, we've been here since the second temple was destroyed. They could trace. It's unbelievable. And there are families. It's actually the Roman Jewish community is the oldest Jewish community in the world. They have the oldest Siddur. They have the oldest liturgy. It's Ashkenaz, but a lot of Ashkenaz Jews like myself who go there are like, what's going on? It's like, right? It's a little different. And there are Jews because when the Romans destroyed the temple, they enslaved many Jews and brought them back to Rome. And Jews have stayed there. And she told me, this woman told me, that there were Jews living there before. There were Jews living there from the First Temple era. But her family, she believed, came from slaves that were made by the Romans, of Jews that were exiled, deported from ancient Israel to Rome. And we've been there for a long time. Yeah?
Weren't many of those slaves brought to Rome responsible for building the Colosseum?
I don't know.
Because I've read several sources that it was built by Jews. Slaves.
It could have been. I doubt Jews were the only people they enslaved. The Romans were a very extraordinarily powerful world power and extraordinarily cruel. And the Colosseum itself, if you watch Gladiator, I don't know how accurate that is, but it's a great movie. Anyway, let's finish up on page 9. We're skipping all the way to the end. We're going to conclude with this, where it's circled. Tanya was taught in a brisa. Amar Rabbi Elezer. Rabbi Elezer said, "Bo ure'e kama gedola kocha shel busha." This is very important at the end because we can kind of lose our way with this whole story, especially if you haven't eaten for like a day. It's like you get like involved in like donut where what, and like all of a sudden we're in the middle. What's going on? He brings us back to the beginning story. What was the story that this whole thing began with? Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. Remember those guys? That feels like 2 hours ago. How long has this been going on? Right?
Where is
Kamsa? Hold on. Let me just finish, and then I'll take your hand. Bo re'e kama gadola kocha shel busha. Come and see how great is the power of busha. Busha is embarrassing. Shehare siyakadosh baruch hu es Bar Kamsa. Because, and we didn't try to justify Bar Kamsa's reaction. He went to the Romans and tried to get the Romans to think that we were rebelling because he was embarrassed at this party and the rabbis were there, nobody said anything. He feels justified to do this. But look and see how great is the power of busha, of shaming another person. Because God himself assisted Bar Kamsa in his plot to take revenge for the shame that he had been subject to. And he destroyed the temple and burnt his sanctuary. So this is very, very important that we understand the point of this whole story. It's interesting. You get a lot of little ins and outs of what was going on between the Roman government and the Jews and the fighting, the Briyanim and all of this. But it all starts out with the way one Jew treats another. And this is extraordinarily important. Really, really important today. It doesn't mean we have to agree with each other. It does mean that we need to be united front when it comes to our enemies. That's why I mentioned Menachem Begin before. because I think one of the things that we've done pretty well, not always, here, was a disaster. We took a bad situation, we made it worse. Because it seems from the Gemara that if the Jewish community within Israel, after Bar Kamtza goes to the Romans and convince them that we could have brokered a peace deal with the Romans through Vespasian. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai and Vespasian, they got it together. And it seems as though, had he gotten out earlier, something different could have happened. So this story in the Talmud is not simply between two Jews. This story in the Talmud is not simply between two Jewish people. It's between groups. How do groups in the Jewish community interact with each other? And this is very, very challenging because we feel so secure and confident in our perspective and in our approach. The Baryanim felt that strongly, that they burnt down the storehouses. 21 years we could have lasted with those storehouses, but they forced the hand of the Jewish community to fight against the Romans when we were not capable of prevailing against them, at least militarily. Maybe if there was a different relationship with God, we could have been like back in the wilderness. God fights all of our battles, no problem. And this is a very important lesson, that when we present ourselves to those who would challenge us, we cannot be coming at them in different groups, and we cannot be fighting amongst ourselves. And this is a very, very challenging thing. But I tried to give an example of someone in modernity who I think navigated that pretty successfully, Menachem Begin, and averted a civil war at a time when a civil war could have been, it literally could have crushed all of the wonderful efforts, the precious little efforts at that infant state of ours to create a Jewish state between the time of literally Auschwitz and the Hakamat HaMedina. Those few years, we could have literally devoured each other. And it's something that unfortunately, or fortunately for us, was helpful in dealing with our Arab enemies. They were fighting amongst themselves. I'm not saying that's something we pray for, but it was helpful, just historically. It has been. And we cannot not allow ourselves to fall prey to that. We're too small of a people. And, you know, Netanyahu always likes to say this. Other leaders have said this as well. That, you know, Israel can't afford ever to really lose. So this is there's a lot riding on this. Liron, you had a question. Let's open it up for some discussion. Yeah.
Right.
The fault is Bar Kamtza because he went and he told on everybody and he tried getting us in trouble. And the fault is the guy who threw the party. We don't know his name. You might be getting confused. The guy who throws the party is a no name. He's got a friend named Kamtza and an enemy named Bar Kamtza. His attendant messes up the invitation. He's never mentioned. Now there's one theory that Kamtza and Bar Kamtza are father and son. I saw this in some of the writings of some of the rabbis. That they're father and son, and that's why Bar Kamtza shows up at the party, because the guy who's throwing the party gets along with the dad, but not the son. So he now thinks, this is the way for my father's friend to make up with me. He's inviting me to his event. That's one theory. Yes, please.
I'm curious, is it possible though that considering we saw how Bar Kamtza behaved after being kicked out of the party, is it possible that there's a good reason why the party did not?
Yeah, so that I've heard that. That's a very good suggestion. A lot of people say, look at the way Bar Kamtza reacted. Maybe there's a reason the rabbis kept quiet when the person who threw the party tried to embarrass him. Maybe he deserved to be embarrassed. What do you think about that? It's an interesting suggestion, no? Maybe he did something really, really awful.
That he was not exactly a reputable member of
the community. No, I think that's the point. You see, we don't really know. I think we don't really know. You know, let's say it was a guy who just obnoxious, refuses to give his wife a get, and he shows up at the party. And that's why he wants him thrown out. He doesn't want this guy who's doing immoral things to be partying it up with him in his home. And the rabbis keep quiet because they agree. That's entirely possible. But we're not really given the luxury to assume that. Now, if you want to give the rabbis the benefit of the doubt, you can do that. But I think the point is that we don't really know. And the Gemara tells us at the very end, look at the power of Busha. Why would the Gemara conclude this whole story by telling us that what? Because this person was shamed, God assisted Bar Kamsa in his plot to get the Jews into trouble with the Romans. So I don't know. It's a very good suggestion you're making, but the Gemara's end seems to indicate that embarrassing him and not saying anything was not justifiable. Question, yeah. Just speak loudly, sir.
I think Busha is such a big thing. I mean, we see in our prayers, that we should never be ashamed. Like, that's,
right.
I'm
You know, it's true, but I will tell you, there was a story of, I could tell this was with Rabbi Marcus. He's a retired rabbi in Israel today. His son's running yeshiva. I knew the family for many years, and he was the rabbi of the Young Israel of Staten Island. Probably the largest Young Israel, like modern Orthodox synagogue. And I remember when I was growing up, he was very strong in order for a woman who's married to be able to remarry, she needs what's called a get. And there was a man in his community who refused to give his wife a get. And on Yom Kippur night, Kol Nidre night, he said, "We are not starting our services. We are not starting our services until so and so." He looked at him, gets up and leaves. Because I've asked him and I've called him numerous times and I've asked him in the Beit Din, we've sent him all these subpoenas to come to court and to do the right thing, and he doesn't. We're not praying with him. You can give your wife a get, we'll pray with you. So there are times when publicly humiliating someone might be not only justified, but called for in certain extreme circumstances. I was thinking about that also, and somebody else years ago when I taught this class had made that suggestion. Maybe that's why the rabbis kept quiet. Maybe that's why the guy was trying to kick him out. Maybe he's a really low life who should not be allowed in, you know? Use your imagination. But the Gemara seems to conclude, the Gemara seems to rule that out at the end. Yes?
I just want to say, first of all, if I was Bar Kamsa, what's the book? You throw me out? I'm going to leave. I don't want to force compulsions. This thing with Vespasian and Zohar, this happened before the actual destruction of the temple, when they had the...
This happened at a very precarious moment between the vassal Jewish state living under the Roman yoke, when there was stuff going on already. So Bar Kamsa's going to Caesar, and he was a big shot, he had a connection with him, going to Caesar and convincing Caesar by causing a blemish in the animal could really tip the scales. It wasn't like everything was hunky-dory between the Jews and the Romans, and he did this one thing, and all of a sudden...
I mean, Rabbi Ben Zohar, when he spoke with Vespasian,
yeah.
Was this before the temple was taken down?
Yes. Yeah, but on the cusps. It was at the end of the siege. Yeah. By the way, does anybody know what happened after the temple was destroyed? Even though there were many... survivors, there were thousands of Jews that were killed, and some of the survivors were exiled to Rome, but many stayed in Israel and continued to fight the Romans for decades. The Bar Kokhba revolt was the most successful attempt at throwing off the oppressive Roman yoke. Masada, I mean, this didn't end with the destruction of the Second Temple. We're to focus on the destruction of the Second Temple because that's really what Tisha B'Av is about. It's about the removal of God's presence. And that's really important. It's really, really important. I don't know how many other civilizations do this. We are so honest with ourselves, sometimes to a fault. But it's pretty unbelievable if you think about it. What do we spend our day doing?
We don't spend our day thinking about how do we could better we could have better strategized with the Romans, or how despicable the Romans were. We spent our day and we spent our Tisha B'Av looking inside and saying, where did we go off? Why were we quiet at the party? How is it that one Jew can embarrass another? How is it? Because that's the way a lot of my teachers understand this story, that this is depicting the state of Jewry at the time. And this is what was happening, and that's what we're looking at today. We're looking at how our midot, our personalities, how are we treating each other? How are we dealing with each other? Because that was the cause of the Second Temple's destruction. And clearly, there's work to be done. And to the degree that we can practice and exercise some more love and respect for each other, we do believe that this could be rectified. I will tell you, I said this last night, and I don't want to get political, but I think it's really, really important. I think it is a modern-day expression of Sinat Chinam, that the last 5-6 years, certainly the last election, you know, we have just become more and more intolerant of whatever other person's perspective there is. I just remember, I'm not that old, but, you know, Democrats and Republicans and conservatives and liberals used to sit in the same room and have real discussions and maybe fight and yell at each other, but have some modicum of respect for the other person's perspective. And not always attribute or project, you know, ill will or motivation on the other. And I really think things have changed for the worse in this. And I was talking to Rabbi Levine about this, you know, could this be seen as some kind of modern expression of sinat chinam, of baseless hatred? That doesn't mean you have to agree with the other person. You could still think they're completely wrong. But to be able to say that they may have a different perspective on things, I need to hear it, take it into consideration, I'll still reject them. But to have some kind of basic modicum of respect, I posted this on my Facebook page last time, it was a great quote from Rav Kook, I don't have it exactly, but to remember that when you're having an argument with another person, you listen to them not just because they're human, but because they may have some truth that we may not, that I may not have stumbled upon. I'm not doing justice to the quote. He says it much more beautifully. You can read, it's what I said last night. I just posted it on my page last night. And it's really, really important. I remember during the last election, people were like, somebody said, it was like one of our, asked the rabbi, can a Democrat date a Republican? I was like, that is ridiculous. That is ridiculous. I was like, really? Are you gonna? No, but we've gotten actually to a situation where it wasn't like an ethical thing. It was like practically, can you really live with someone with whom you disagree like that? And it's not healthy for Israel either. It's not healthy for Israel. It's not healthy for our society within the Jewish community, outside the Jewish community. There has to be some kind of respect for an opposing view. I mean, the whole tenor of Talmudic debate and discourse, we arrive at the truth by having opposing views clashing up against each other. That's how you arrive at the truth. And it's a difficult situation, and it becomes very complicated. We're a small community, and when we have a lot of support, let's say for Israel, how do we deal with? Because I do believe we have to have a unified front when it comes to dealing with our enemies or the outside community. We have to try to get it together internally, and that's not simple because there's a lot of divergence of opinion as to how to deal with some very sensitive issues. I'm not saying we can fix that here on Tisha B'Av, but I think we need to think about it and to practice a little more love and respect and take this story to heart, to be very, very careful about not shaming, God forbid, another person. And don't walk away, please, from this story thinking, oh, and if you do get shamed, it's okay to do something awful. Okay, because I hear that a lot also. Going on a bad date, or something goes bad, all of a sudden it's okay to badmouth somebody in the community. Because that happens a lot, unfortunately, as well. Just because we were wronged doesn't mean we aren't expected to still take the high road. It's hard, and there's a part of us that just wants to get back at the person, say nasty things about him, because that's a quick and easy way of making ourselves feel better. But we've just reduced ourselves. We've just brought ourselves down to the lowest common denominator, and we're better than that. And that's what the Talmud, I think, one of the great lessons the Talmud is trying to teach us. Michael, did you have any other comments or questions? I don't want to keep you guys here endlessly or long. We're going to take just a few minute break. We're going to be davening Maariv, evening service, in a few minutes here. And we're going to have a little breakfast as well at 8:31. You guys did it. It's another 30 minutes. It's nothing. Great. Okay, thank you all for being here. And I want to thank all the fans and Facebook. And really, thank you so much for participating and for videoing this. Thank you. Should be our last Tisha B'Av, guys. There will always be a Tisha B'Av, but the next one should be in Yerushalayim, rejoicing with festivity. Thank you.